Hey everyone, welcome back to another great episode of the Forged by Trust podcast. My name is Robin Dreek and I'm your host. I'm the former head of the FBI Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, as well as the founder and CEO of People Formula, a leadership and communication strategies company. With me today is a returning guest, Abby Marano. Abby is a nonverbal communications and social influence coach and a university lecturer in social psychology. Abby began publishing scientific articles on nonverbal communication at 19 and went on to achieve her PhD in behavioral analysis before founding and directing the research group Brink. She's also the director of education at socialengineer.com and a great friend and sharer of amazing information surrounding the nonverbals of trust. During today's amazing episode, we're going to dive deeper on trust, transparency, assessing others from a distance, and believe not, the effect that our diets have on our abilities to understand ourselves and others. So as always, please leave a review as well as likes across your favorite podcasting platforms. And before we even get going on this one, I want to remind everyone that up next is Jeff Gibbard, and he'll be discussing his book, and that is The Lovable Leader. And finally, remember, if you want to forge trust in your life, the greatest primer in the world is begin with rapport. And so a great primer for building rapport is my book, It's Not All About Me. It's a quick read, and you can get it on Amazon or check it out in the show notes, as well as my Audible version of the book, which I'm really excited about because I'm giving you some really extra tools in there. And that is at the very end of the Audible version, you get the full podcast with my good friend Jack Schaefer talking about the truth detector and all his tools and techniques, where we take rapport to the next level and talk about elicitation. So as always, get your pen and paper out, sit back, relax, and enjoy this amazing in-depth episode with Abby and our discussion surrounding trust.
There we go. Good afternoon.
Yeah.
Sorry, for some reason, it wasn't letting me get into Zoom, but I am. I can see us in your background. I like that.
Yes, there we are. I love putting graphics together, and that's one of the reasons why it's fun to do a pre-show, so we can actually lock on the topic, especially when you're talking to one of the most trustworthy people I know in my entire life. And what we're going to be talking about today is like the opposite, like how you blow trust. But I was thinking about why, and it's because you are so exceptionally predictable, transparent, forthright, which makes for great trust. And so it's funny, I was watching the clock tick down and I saw we were at 10 a.m. my time. And I knew that if you weren't here right at 10:00, there was something going on because you are so predictable. And you came on, the first thing you said was, I'm so sorry. And for everyone watching, it was 10:59 seconds. So she's right there and she still apologized for it. So how are you, Abby?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I had this epiphany today, and you have made such a tremendous impact. And that's just through our show, but I know in your own life and all the other things you're doing, and you are literally changing the world. And so I think we're going to keep going on and changing the world because, matter of fact, I'm getting the math out of here to put it out. The guy that wrote this book, Make Your Bed, he actually goes through the math about how you can change the world if you make a difference in six people's lives positively. I think it's how many generations away you can actually change the entire world. So that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to keep changing the world because I definitely think we can. So congratulations on your new position with Social Engineer. Congratulations, most importantly, on the PhD in front of your name, the doctor.
Yes, that is very, very exciting to see. I thought I would celebrate after I was awarded my doctorate. I honestly slept for about 3 days. I didn't even celebrate. I slept.
I bet it must have been so emotionally exhausting. It's psychologically exhausting to go through that. I can't imagine.
Yep. But it just means now, that is out of the way. And my PhD was not a great experience. It was just so tough. And there was so much turmoil during the time that I was doing it. So it was an exciting journey for me, but it's one that I'm very excited to put behind me and just move on with this next stage. And like you said, on the to-do list, we've got, you know, change the world. So we got lots of work to do.
Yes. And we're going to keep doing that. I'm curious, you said it was so challenging and getting a PhD into itself is challenging. What additional challenges were you having? I imagine it's COVID, but I don't want to keep guessing.
Yep. So I think when you go into the PhD, you think, I mean, just like anything, you think, okay, well, I just need to do this one thing. And I just thought, okay, well, I knew it was going to be tough. And I was funded for my PhD. It was a 3-year funding. It got extended for 6 months because of the pandemic. But you go in and think, okay, well, I just need to conquer this one thing, this PhD. And you kind of forget that around that you have, you know, other stuff. You have money and family and health and relationships and friendships. And then none of that is really considered at all. And then you have to deal with the stress of the PhD. And I think the PhD is so difficult because not only are you doing, you know, new research and things like that, but you have to actually create something brand new out of what we have, but create a big impact. And that's so difficult because we're starting from, you know, informed decisions, but to really create something brand new that and discover something with practical value is really difficult. And, you know, I had lots of family things going on at the same time and personal things. And that just wasn't something that I thought would happen during my PhD. I just thought I can go, I work hard, I study hard, I'm organized, and it will be perfect. It'll be fine. And then you figure, oh, I have to actually, you know, live for these next 3.5 years. And then the pandemic, I mean, my PhD was using motion capture and it was in person looking at nonverbal mimicry of the lower body. So doing that was particularly difficult virtually, and I had to restructure everything. But it was just not a great journey for me. And I'm very grateful that, you know, that I went through it and I got out the other side finally as a doctor. It all feels worth it because someone asked me today if I was a miss or a missus, and I got to say, oh, no, sorry, it's doctor. And then you just think, oh, 3.5 years are worth it now.
But you brought up so many powerful things there. You can't appreciate things unless you have context. The world is nothing but dichotomies, and the dichotomy of the struggle makes the gain, yeah, you know, so much more powerful to you. I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, you had to innovate massively throughout this entire thing, which makes you resilient, makes you smarter. It solves problems. And also, I imagine, relationships had to get you through this because this was not a solo act, correct?
See, I think for me, it was quite the opposite. I work a lot and I'm very happy when I'm working. And the way that I kind of managed to stay productive was to say, okay, well, I need to prioritize my work above all else. So relationships were just a no. You know, friendships were kind of put on a hold. I have my friends, but they would send me calendar invites for a coffee. When I say I worked a lot, I really mean, you know, I worked from the second I got up to the second I went to bed, because I didn't just want to come out with my PhD. I did so much other stuff at the same time, because I knew that, you know, it's a very competitive world. And I wanted to come out with something that pushed me forward, not just the PhD. And I knew that if you have extraordinary goals, you have to be willing to put extraordinary work in. So I kind of gave up everything else to just get it done. But what kind of changed for me is I was very work focused and just not very restful. I didn't really give myself a break. And I was always kind of pushing the people around me to do the same. And I never really got that. You know, why would you take a break? And it wasn't really until that I had family health issues that I actually realized the importance of being trusting with other people and being respectful of their time and being respectful of my time, because I still have my superiors pushing me to work like a robot. And then you realize, you know, everybody has things going on in their life, your employee, your colleague, your boss, absolutely everybody has things going on that you don't see. So you can't treat everybody like work robots. You have to treat everybody like you would want to be treated if you were going through something, because you don't know if they are. So that really changed for me, because my whole perspective before was very like tough love, you know, just work hard, get over it. And that's always the way that I've been. until I kind of needed someone not to be that way to me. And then you realize, God, I've got to change how I am to other people. And then since that point, you know, I've made such an effort to change the way that I act with people. And, you know, when we talk about being trustworthy and acting trustworthy, it really does change your life. When you make other people feel good around you, it really does change just everything.
What would you term it? Is it empathy that you think you gain more of?
Yeah, I think it was empathy more, you know, because I was so work orientated that you just focus on getting things done. And, you know, I really did kind of just treat my life like very robotic, you know, get up, work out, work, and go to bed. And everything was just work focused, and it was very like systematic. So I just kind of expected everybody else in a work environment to all be exactly the same. If you have a job, do it. You know, if you've got a job to do, just get it done. You know, don't bring your personal life to work. And when I couldn't not bring my personal life to work, it made me realize that actually everybody might not be able to not bring their personal life to work too. And you just have to treat everybody like they could be going through something, because I don't want to be that person that pushes someone a bit too hard, or I can see that they're struggling and I just tell them to go get it done. And then I make things worse for them. You know, you want to be that person that people can rely on, because if you do want the work to get done, pushing people past their limits isn't going to get it done any quicker. It's just going to stop it completely and lose good people. So it was definitely empathy and just, you know, a big learning curve for me in terms of both academically and in general, you know, how to treat myself and how to treat other people.
That is profound, beautiful. And I don't mean, it's not an insulting word, it's exceptionally mature and self-aware. I've worked with many, many people, including on myself, because being that type A that just thinks it's all about the things I'm doing to succeed and everyone around you is the same, it's only half the equation. The other half is the interpersonal communication, our ability to interact. One of my anecdotes I love to say is, we are meant to be cooperative, great human beings, interacting and forging great relationships and trust with others, because otherwise we'd be on this planet alone. We are biologically coded to need relationships for just such the times you mentioned. So what a fantastic, I say it's fantastic. That's a fantastic journey. Anytime people have these massive aha moments of expansion of what is in your own life is a great moment. So, and I didn't mean to digress there, because I know, but I think it's a really fantastic lead in to the things we're going to be talking about today. Oh, and the one other teaser, I am excited because we heard back, and thank you so much for doing a legwork with our good friend, Joe Navarro.
Yep.
For those listening, this will be out before the Abby and Joe show, where the three of us are going to be on together, and all I'm going to do is sit back, listen, and watch this show, because Abby and Joe are going to share amazing insights. So with that, Abby, one of the things, you know, when we did our pre-show kind of chatting about what we could talk about next, I love the fact that you have a ton that you want to dive into, and that's why the title of today's show is, what is it again? Threats to Trust. And we kind of gave it a great preliminary with your experiences with it. So with that, thanks for coming back. I did my teasers. So let's start out with that overarching question. What is trust?
Yep. So I think, like anything in psychology, academics complicate things. And this idea of trust has been really overcomplicated in the literature. And I mean, you'll see different definitions everywhere. And then we have things like cognitive trust, which is this, you know, logical reasoning of trust and calculations, have affective trust, which is, you know, more feelings, and behavioral trust. So, you know, trusting behavior. And it's quite unclear in the literature how much they overlap, how distinct they are, and things like this. And I really just think it's overcomplicated, because to me, I just see trust as safety. What makes us feel safe? Because that's what we want as human beings. That is our ultimate drive, to feel safe. And when we feel safe, we are in a space where we can then release trust to other people. So once we make someone else feel safe, that trust will come to us. So it's not about us. It's not about what can I do to make them trust me, like we said before. It's what can I do to make them feel safe? And that trust will come to us.
I love that. Trust is safety. And our good friend Joe, even at the fifth trait in the exceptional individuals, you know, creates psychological comfort, which is safety in others. And again, that it can be very subjective, but I think we can really break it down into actually particular actions people can do. So with that kind of definition, where do you go from there?
So in terms of creating trust or...
Yeah, because I know we're going to talk about the threats to trust, but I love, as I've never heard it before, the three areas of trust, and it really boils down to safety. And so what kind of things, you maybe one or two, maybe three things people can start to do to create that feeling of safety in others, and also then be recognizing it to see when trust is blown so we can transition into that.
Yep. So I think this actually fits really nicely into trust breakdown as well, because anything that we do to create trust, not doing it or, you know, doing the opposite is the breakdown of trust. So I think, you know, we've got to start with transparency. Being transparent is the first thing to create trust, and not being transparent will lead to trust breakdown. Because if we're not transparent, if we're holding information back from someone, or we're being deceptive, which is even worse, it creates this aura of untrustworthiness. Because as human beings, if the ultimate goal is safety, we want all of the information so we can assess it and then assess, okay, is this safe? If we don't have all of the information, we cannot make that assessment because something is not being forthcoming. So what we're going to do is make up a scenario of what we think. And it's the same as we talked about with neutral faces, that there isn't really such thing as neutrality. If there are no cues of trustworthiness, our brain says, okay, well, there's no evidence that it's trustworthy. So therefore, to save myself, I'm going to say it's not. It's the same with not being transparent. If we can't see all the information, it's not processed like a lack of information. It's processed negatively, because there's no evidence, it's not a threat. So our brain says, okay, well, it could be a threat. Therefore, I'm going to act like it is a threat. There is this temptation, especially as a leader or a colleague, to hold certain bits of information back. Maybe you kind of want to protect that person from worrying, or, you know, you don't know fully what the outcome is going to be. So you want to hold a bit of information back. But when you do that, 9 times out of 10, the story that people are going to make up in their heads of what that information is going to be much worse than the actual information you're holding back. If you say, you know, we need to have a meeting later today and it's something serious, that whole day, that person is going to be in their head, what did I do? What did I do? What did I do? And it's actually going to be more than likely a lot worse than actually what you want to speak to them about. So it's so much better to be forthcoming to begin with. And there's a misconception around transparency that it means, you know, telling everybody all of the information. And that's just oversharing. That's not transparency. Transparency just means providing people context to their decisions. So providing them relevant information and not holding any relevant information back. So if we're talking about things that happened in a meeting on Saturday, I don't need to tell you about things that happened in a meeting on Tuesday or Monday that might not be related. Being transparent is just providing them that information that they need. And that is so important to trustworthiness and so vital to ensuring that you're not perceived as untrustworthy.
Yeah. And providing that information is so critical because from my understanding of it, one of the greatest things for us to feel safe is a sense of control and power. And we get that when we can make decisions, and we can only make decisions if we have information. And so when someone provides us the relevant information, we feel in control of making decisions. And it's critical, no doubt. So how do you then deal with, because there are individuals, I think you've probably met them. I've met them. I've probably been this person, hopefully not anymore, that says, I just want to be honest with you. And then here it comes. And these are the type of people that are trying to disguise themselves as being transparent and honest, when in reality, they're actually just being hurtful. How do you deal with that? And why do people do that? And what's that do to trust?
What that does to trust is just break it down. When we say, you know, when people say, oh, you know, it's really nice that you have the confidence to wear that. those backhanded comments of, you know, pretending you're saying something nice and actually saying something really horrible, or pretending you're doing something to help someone out and you're actually doing it for your own benefit. We are very receptive of those things, and it gives us this just bad taste in our mouth. You know, when you're around someone and you can't quite put your finger on what it is, but you just feel unnerved, you feel that sense of, you know, something's wrong. Those kinds of people, you know, you can tell them how you feel, but if you do get that kind of, I don't want to say vibe, but feeling from somebody, the best thing to do is just remove yourself from the situation if you can, because you're not their therapist. You're not there to change their personality. You're not there to assess them. You're there to make other people feel good, but you're nobody's punching bag. If somebody is not treating you how you deserve to be treated, you shouldn't go out of your way to do the same for them. It's so much better to treat everybody with respect. But when you realize, okay, this is actually becoming harmful to me, I refuse to put myself in this situation. And it does get difficult when it's your boss or it's someone that's your superior. And that's when we really need to make this active choice of, you know, is this the right place for me? Mm-hmm. You know, is there something that I can move on to that I feel would be happier? And this is one thing that, you know, we train leaders. If you don't act in a respectful and validating way to your employees, if you are that person, like you said, that just is being very resistant, is being very manipulative, people will feel that. And people below you, they will move on, because, you know, if they stay, they're not going to be happy. They're not going to be productive. They're not going to respect you. So they're not going to work their best. So it really is in everybody's best interest to learn how to be trustworthy and actually become the person that you're trying to manipulate people into thinking you are.
Yeah, because that comes down to so many things. If you're incongruent as a leader with what you're saying and your actions are, that completely blows trust. And what you're really speaking about is what Simon Sinek in his, you know, book, You Start With Why, as well as, you know, Leaders Eat Last, is the golden circle, where people feel safe, because no feeling of safety, No innovation, no solving challenges and problems in life, which every day presents. I found it a fascinating thing. I was just reflecting recently with my son. We were talking. The world is fascinating in the sense that we are all seeking and we hate change, because change means we're no longer psychologically comfortable. Yeah. Yet humans are horrible when we have abundance. I think it's a state of the world where we see things now, especially in the States. You have two extremely polar opposites when it comes to politics right now. It's because the United States has really had a lot of abundance in the last bunch of years. And so when you deal with abundance, human beings stop innovating and they go and they get crazy brain. And it's just because we need struggle, because genetically we have had hundreds of thousands of years of evolution that says we need to innovate to survive. And it's amazing what happens. And I just think of your example of going through your PhD. That was stressful. It was a struggle. And you had to innovate. And you learned a tremendous amount, not just from your academic side, but on multiple facets of your life, it sounds like, because you had to solve problems. And you just got to keep up with the tempo. And as I say often, there's no SOP or standing operating procedure for chaos. You just have to lean in and go and innovate as you go through. So if you're an individual that you did a great example of, all right, so don't do unhealthy relationships. Basically, if someone is placing their, I'm just being honest with you on you as they give you insults, backhanded or not. So how do you ensure that you're not the one doing that? Do you have any personal things or safeguards you do to make sure that you're not going to inflict your own insecurities, or, you know, which comes out a lot of times as judgments on someone else that have been effective for you?
Yeah, I think we just have to kind of step away and be self-aware. And self-awareness is really, really difficult, because we are driven unconsciously a lot. You know, we know that loads of things affect us without our realization, but we just have to step back and say, okay, am I assessing things objectively? Did I react that way to what someone said out of ego? Were they telling me about their achievements? And then was I telling them instantly about mine? Was I trying to one up them? Okay, well, why was I doing that? Because it's getting down to the why. You know, if someone's telling you something they're excited about, and then you try and make them feel really small for being excited about them, And this is something you see quite a lot. You get someone that's, you know, they've achieved something or they've done something really exciting to them. And then the reaction from the other person is just, oh. And instantly that person feels tiny. Mm. And what you have to kind of ask yourself is, why did I do that? Why am I having such a bad day? Or why am I in such a bad mood that making someone else feel like this was a threat to me? Okay, well, why are their achievements felt like a threat to me? What is it that I'm missing in myself or in my actions or my behaviors that mean that I have to act this way to other people to get some kind of gratification? You know, it's just that self-awareness of not only, you know, realize when we're doing it, but reflecting back and thinking, okay, well, what is the reason behind this? And how do I address this in myself before I can then interact with other people and address it, you know, in our interactions? Because these things are really, really personal. And whenever someone is, you know, we see a lot of hate online and people attacking other people. And what I think is, what is going on in your life or in your head that you have to attack someone like that? You know, why do you get up in the morning and think, I'm going to make someone else feel really negative today? What is it that you are missing, that you are filling with these negative thoughts and these negative behaviors? Because there's something really positive missing there. What can you do to fill that space with positivity towards yourself rather than trying to drain other people's positivity? And I think that's where a lot of it comes from. When people aren't feeling positive, they kind of try and take other people's, that, you know, I'm going to take yours, or how dare you feel positive when I don't. And that is something that, I, as I said before, you can't force someone else to treat you a certain way. If someone isn't treating you very well and you're treating them well, it has nothing to do with you. It's a them problem. And there's only so much we can help other people. We should always try and help other people. We see people in distress, we should reach out a hand, but not when they're going to just push our hand back repeatedly so much that it becomes painful for us. We've got to know our limits and be willing to help at the same time.
Yeah, very well said. Huge self-awareness. A great saying to go through life with is, don't allow yourself to be collateral damage in anyone else's insecurities.
Yeah, exactly.
But now here's the big challenge, and you mentioned it a little bit already. So what do you do when you're kind of forced in that situation? I mean, I'm in a place in my life where I can walk away from unhealthy relationships. It's a choice in my life. And it's not through out of maliciousness or get back at you or anything else. It's just, I just don't do unhealthy because it's not an energy I'm looking for in my life. And hopefully people come to the aha moment, they come back and they're welcomed with open, loving arms if they are. And luckily I don't have a lot of that, or actually I don't even have any of that, fortunately. But there are many of us that have to live, work with, and deal with some pretty unhealthy people. What kind of strategies can you give them that will help them not be collateral damage in someone else's insecurities?
I mean, boundaries are so important, you know, knowing when to reach out and help people and know, okay, they're my superior, so I should be doing these things, versus, okay, where do I draw the line? I should be doing these things, but not these things. And it is important to front it, because a lot of the time people might be very unaware of how they're making you feel. Mm. When I look back to how I was before, because I was so work, 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 that is all I was focused on. And I just expected other people around me to be the same. And it wasn't that I didn't care. It's that it just didn't really cross my mind that other people might not want to just work all the time. So when, if you say to someone, look, I'm really sorry, you've made me feel this way, or I'm really sorry, but I can't actually deal with this because of this reason, or you don't even have to give a reason, just, you know, something personal's happened, or I just don't feel I can do this. This is how you are making me feel. Hopefully that person will then say, I'm sorry, and actually realize I've made this person feel a way that I didn't mean to. Because I don't think that people are naturally very malicious. I think a lot of people are very unaware of themselves and unaware of their behavior. And then they hurt people, or they act a certain way to people and make people feel uncomfortable or make people feel really negative, because they're not thinking about how that person's going to respond to their behavior, because they're just thinking about how they would respond to their behavior. So fronting it and saying, this is how you've made me feel, this is how I would like to go forward in the future. And just being open and honest, because without that, if we don't front our feelings and say to somebody how it's making us feel, they're not mind readers. Right. You know, we expect people to be aware, but we can't expect people to just know if, you know, if we don't tell them. So it is part on us as well to say, this is how I prefer things to move forward. And then it gives them the opportunity to change their behavior. And if not, if you are stuck in this really negative environment, the only thing to do is get out, because it isn't beneficial to anybody to be in that situation. And it's better to be in a job that you enjoy a little bit less and, you know, move somewhere that you enjoy a little bit less, but you feel respected while you find your way, rather than be in this job that you love the work, but you are surrounded in this environment where you feel invalidated, where you feel really negative, because that is what's going to encroach on your mental health massively.
More than anything else. So Abby, and so here's another aspect of trustworthiness, and you're doing a phenomenal job of it, and that is vulnerability. I mean, being transparent with the things that you went through on your discovery path, as we all do. I mean, everyone knows that. Yes. Listens to me. I am exceptionally transparent on being a moron. But I'm curious, did you, as you're talking about how to deal with someone and work with someone that is being toxic towards you, did you have anyone that made you aware of it, or did you come to it on your own that you were too focused on work?
So I came to it on my own because somebody else made me feel that way. And it was someone that I respected a lot. And I saw kind of my behavior was very similar to their behavior. You know, he was someone that I highly valued, respected, looked up to. And he had this amazing career that one day I was thinking, you know, imagine being that successful. You know, that is all I thought about was, you know, the top of the world is this amazing career. And he was treating me the way that I treat people, just as workers. And that worked for me because I liked being efficient. I liked just being very professional. And it was when someone that I respected and that I saw myself in, or, you know, my behaviors in, treated me a way that made me feel really negative. And I just thought, well, that is how I treat other people. Other people must be feeling the same because I don't know what they're going through. And it was this, you know, big awareness moment where I just thought, this has to change. And if we go back to that self-awareness, I never meant anybody harm. I've never meant to, you know, I've never manipulated anybody. I've never meant to push people past their limits. But thinking back, how work orientated I was, I had research assistants, I had students working on projects. And, you know, I expected top quality work from top quality students. And you can't just treat people that way, right? Because they are human beings. At the end of the day, you can expect top quality work, but you have to expect it from human beings, not robots. And that is something that I had to get my head around, because I just saw, like I said, I just saw myself as like a working robot, work, 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 work. And that is not how people need to be treated.
I'm going to repeat that right now. That is one of my quotable quotes I'm taking away from this one, is you can expect high quality work, but you have to expect it from human beings.
Yeah, and not robots.
Yeah, that is a very truism. No doubt. Thank you. So kind of going through the things that we wanted to talk about. So you'd mentioned, do we judge the trustworthiness of others before we interact? You know, in other words, as a third party observer, what do we do?
Yes. So we judge trustworthiness from people before we interact with them. So when we observe two people interacting, we are making assessments of those two people before we interact with them. And this is something that I did in my PhD. I looked at how we observe two people interacting and how their behaviors to each other influence our willingness to cooperate with those individuals. And if we don't see cohesive behaviors between them, even though they have done nothing to us, we are less likely to want to cooperate with them, and we don't perceive them as very trustworthy. So it really has nothing to do with us at that point. But again, it comes back to safety. We want to know what we're stepping into. And that idea, like you said, of being in control. We're not just going to step into an environment full of people and not trying to assess what they're going to be like to us. You know, what kind of guards we need to put up? Are we safe around these people? So of course, we make judgments of people from a third party. And this is something that people don't really consider. If they're just, you know, talking away, or you have a boss shouting at an employee, or a boss treating someone a certain way, and then they call you in for an interview, or they call you in for a partnership, you've just observed them being a certain way to another person. No matter how nice they are to you, you've just witnessed them being negative to somebody else. So you've already formed that opinion of that person does not make me feel safe. That person has given me this feeling of untrustworthiness. Therefore, I'm going to step into this interaction already knowing I don't trust this person. This is not a person I want to do a partnership with.
So when Abby walks into a room, Abby, how do you assess who you're going to have a conversation with? What are you looking for?
I look for attention. So when you see two people talking, are they paying attention to each other? Are they orientated towards each other? Or is one person kind of listening but doing their own thing? If anyone is on their phone, it's a no. But if they're listening to someone, but their body is orientated somewhere different, maybe, you know, their feet are towards the door, or they're not actively listening, that just says to me, you know, they're waiting for you to finish to either go or to say their point. It's that active attention that I look for, and that just respect of, you know, maybe I am busy, but whilst you are talking to me, I'm going to be present in this conversation and show you that respect rather than indicate to you, I want to go. You know, if you need to go, just apologize, say, I really need to go. Right. Don't take your attention away from that person and make them feel like what they have to say or their presence isn't validated. So that's the one thing that I mostly look for, is that respect and that being present in the conversation.
And even if they do have to go, if you're transparent about you have to go, instead of trying to hide it and using subterfuge in some way, it's very genuine, because I don't believe people, you know, are looking for anyone to be perfect. They're looking for a great effort. You know, I think all these things with transparency display that great effort. So your new huge greatest fan, CK Golding, who I just released his episode today, he talks about just this technique he uses, is put the cell phone down. You know, don't even look at it, put it on silence. Don't, you know, when it rings, don't even look at the screen to see who it is before you even go back to the conversation. Because that's, say, you're now assessing the worthiness of me conversing with you. Yeah. Nope, you just put that cell phone down, make them, like you said, the entire center and focus of that conversation.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to respect. It's that I'm paying attention to you. I might be busy, but while you're speaking, you can't hear me typing away on my laptop. You can't hear me rummaging around doing things, because that shows, you know, I'm listening to you, but I'm not actively listening. And I just think that is really disrespectful, that I have better things to do than what you're saying to me. And we said, if you're busy, say, I'm really busy. I really want to know what you want to tell me, but I can't right now. Let's wait till a time when I can actually give you my active attention, because that is perceived much better than just having someone on the phone or in a conversation while you're doing other things, because it's very disrespectful, because, like I said, it just says that I don't care about what you're telling me.
You use that word a lot, respect. So it's obviously, it's very important to you, and you've given us a lot of good tips of things that you're looking for. Is there one really huge pet peeve that you see all the time that drives you up a wall? In other words, if someone wants to be friends with Abby, what do you got to make sure you never, ever do?
Good manners, I think, is something that is really, really important that people don't place enough importance on, because we've all been taught as kids the valuable lesson that good manners cost nothing, which is true, but bad manners are expensive. We lose relationships. We lose trust with bad manners. When people are impolite, we equate this with untrustworthiness. If someone cuts you off, it's impolite when they don't let you finish. When you're having a debate and they don't let you get your point across, it's impolite, and that's perceived as untrustworthy. You know, and different cultures have very different perceptions of what's polite. Like in us Brits, if you don't hold the door open for us, or you don't say thank you when we've held the door open, it's a travesty. That is just, you know, that is extremely impolite and perceived very, very badly. But online manners are actually really, really important too. And there was a really interesting study, and I love this study. It was looking at the manners of virtual feedback. So people were doing sort of e-learning tasks. We all know we've had to do these awful e-learning tasks for many different jobs, but also things like when you go onto a website and it has a little chat bot pop up. And it was looking at people that did these e-learning tasks, and then they got feedback, and then they had to do a new task. And I looked at how that feedback was presented to them. And if the feedback was polite, you know, thank you for completing the task, well done, it improved the learning on subsequent tasks. It improved the satisfaction, and it also improved the ratings of trustworthiness of the whole organization. So the people providing the courses. And if the feedback was untrustworthy, the organization was perceived as less trustworthy. And they did worse on the subsequent tasks, and they were less satisfied. And this really speaks to how sensitive we are to good manners, because even if it's online, and even if it's not even by a human, it has an effect. And this is something that people should consider when designing a website, when designing, you know, virtual advisors or e-learning software, that the feedback that we are giving to people, it has an effect on our perceptions of trustworthiness and the perceptions of trustworthiness of the whole company. So this is something to think about, that just, again, is not really thought about, because we just think it's not physical feedback, but we are so sensitive to manners and to people being polite or perceived as rude.
I have just become so hyper self-conscious about my internet presence.
You're gonna go back and change everything to thank you for visiting.
I gotta go double check everything from when you sign up to my newsletter to a Calendly invite. I gotta make sure I got everything proper.
Yours is very, very polite.
Okay, thank you. So I try. I hate those I statements. CK made me so focused on those as well, and I apologize. Got to keep you focused. And being polite is so critical. And I think the world that people live in online, they create this anonymity, and they think they can hide from being polite, and they can be rude, and it destroys fabrics of society, I think.
Yeah, and, just...
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just on the I moment, I think it is important to give people a chance to speak, but I think it is important to have I and you, because we know that reciprocal self-disclosure equates to increased trustworthiness and increased closeness. So it's hard to find that balance between how much of myself do I speak about versus how much do I allow you to speak? Because just allowing one person to speak, it might be good for their ego, but actually having that reciprocal me, you, I is actually more beneficial for trust, because it is that reciprocal self-disclosure. So I think you do a great job.
Thank you. I am so self-conscious of it. Matter of fact, you know, as I keep right to the left of the screen, you know, no one can see it, but it's right in front of me. I have, you know, about five lines of show notes I put here to make sure things to cover. And the number one thing I have at the top of everything, focus on you questions and not I statements. Before I talk to anyone, I do this because I love sharing anecdotes and stories, and I at the same time, because when you're sharing everything you're doing, it is such a natural reaction that humans have of anecdote and story pops into my mind to reciprocate. Hey, I have a similar experience, because we're constantly testing the person we're interacting with. Do you accept me non-judgmentally for who I am? The only way I can test it is share my thoughts and opinions with you, and I'm looking for that validation. So obviously I'm sharing that I'm incredibly insecure and I need validation all the time. So thank you very much for my validation. The last thing before I want to open it up to anything I did miss that we chat about, looking from afar, how accurate are our judgments and trustworthiness when assessing others?
So we have to actually remember, when we make judgments about other people, about their trustworthiness, about anything that we are inducing about their personality, it's not accurate. It can never be accurate, because how would we possibly measure that? How would we possibly measure accurate trustworthiness? All it is this consistent judgment of perceived trustworthiness. And I think the difference between perceived and actual trustworthiness is really, really important, because an understanding of what is perceived positively, this positive person perception, gives us an opportunity to become more aware of our behavior and ensure that we are adapting it to make other people feel good. If we know that things are perceived really negatively, like we see a lot of people use curse words for effect, but it has a really negative effect on how they're perceived. So they do it for this shock factor. But I've never really understood why you would want to shock people into feeling uncomfortable to make a presence, because that's what that shock factor is. It's making somebody feel a bit uncomfortable, making somebody feel a bit, you know, unsure. And that is perceived as untrustworthy. We want to make sure that we know what is perceived positively, and we are adapting our behaviors to make people feel as comfortable and as safe as possible. But it is important that they are not actual assessments. We cannot measure trustworthiness like that. We can just measure perceived trustworthiness, but it just gives us an opportunity to then work on our own behavior.
So if you have a few people in your life, I have a few people in my life, and I assess them for, as I term it, I love your definition, it's people that make you feel safe. For me, safety is reliability and consistency, because I can then predict what you're going to do. You're going to show up on time. You're going to be very well prepared. So I've come to really trust you, Abby, to do certain things and be a certain human being, because you're extremely consistent with how you engage me and those around you. So I deem you exceptionally trustworthy. So is that accurate? I guess my question here is, what do you do and what can people do if they're trying to really hard to assess, can I trust this person? What should they be looking for?
So we have to, again, it comes to that self-awareness. We know that we can only make accurate judgments, or we can only pick up on these cues if the other things are not affecting us. So we're constantly surrounded by stimuli, and, you know, our environment, what we've just been through, conversations we've had, we are affected by things consciously and unconsciously. And we can only make judgments about other people from their behavior accurately if those other things are not overriding our judgments. You know, so we know that when we're angry or we're scared, we perceive neutral faces as threatening. Because what we've just been through, say someone has just scared us, been through a negative event, we then misinterpret the world around us. And it's that awareness of, you know, I need to self-reflect. I need to realize maybe that person didn't say that thing that someone said, they didn't mean it that way. We've all gone into an argument and said, well, you said this and it was the way you said it. Is it actually the way they said it? Or is it the way you perceived it because of how you felt? So we really have to kind of step away from ourselves. And that's really, really difficult to do, because it does take a lot of awareness. And things that we wouldn't expect to affect our judgments do, like the temperature of a room. If a room is too cold, we perceive other people as more cold. If we are drinking a cold drink versus a warm drink, we perceive people as less warm. And these are things that when we're making judgments about other people, we don't think, oh, you know, I don't think you're very warm because I'm having, you know, an ice lolly or something. We just don't connect those two things. And that just shows how unconsciously things do affect our behavior. But when we do have knowledge of what cues change people's judgment, it does give us some kind of control over our environment, because it means that, say, if we have a business meeting or we're going to have a negotiation, if we do know that there are things in the environment or certain times of day that affect people's judgments, we can try and create an atmosphere that makes people feel safe and comfortable.
I'm sorry, I got fixated on that word ice lolly.
Is that a British thing?
That's a British thing. Is that we call them ice pops? Is that an ice pop?
I think we have ice pops, but that's like a certain type of ice lolly. Oh. So yeah, maybe that's a British thing for the audience there.
And getting back to what you said, though, I actually did hear everything after that as well. That is one of the most challenging things in the world, is understanding your own context when taking in information. Yes. And we're extremely poor at it. As much as I wish I was good at it and thought I was good at it, I am fantastic at it for you, because when I'm not emotionally attached to the outcome I'm seeking, I can be extremely objective in my observations. And so I think the most important thing ever always is to have what I call that loving critic that is vested in your success, but objective when assessing what's going on around you.
Yep.
And they're extremely helpful people to have in your life.
Yep. And one thing we will talk about on the next podcast that people don't think about is how our diets, just what we eat generally, you know, what kind of supplements we take, massively affect how accurately we are judging other people. They affect our trust to ourselves, and it affects how we are perceiving other people. And it might seem like a weird link, but it is a direct link from diet to behavior, emotions, perception, and how we interact with other people. So we will get into that next time. But on that, what you should know as a leader is when you are having meetings, make sure you're not having, you know, white bread sandwiches and cheese and crackers out. Have something that isn't full of sugar either. Have warm coffee, because we know that when people drink warm drinks, they're more welcoming. They perceive other people as more welcoming. So get, you know, have water, but don't have lots and lots of orange juice. Yep. Have lots and lots of hot coffee, hot tea, you know, other warm beverages. I can't think of any other than coffee, but I'm sure there's some out there. And make sure the food you have available. When do you ever see salads available anywhere in conferences? You know, there's no salads, there's no healthy food, there's no, you know, cucumber sticks or, you know, anything that actually boosts energy and makes people feel good. You have all these really heavy foods. And when we are eating heavy foods and our body is processing this, our body is too busy dealing with inflammation to deal accurately with information and make accurate judgments. So actually, we're doing ourselves a disservice when we are not providing people appropriate food during meetings. And that has a direct link to the outcome of negotiations.
As fantastic lead in and teaser for our next episode. And so here's what you kind of gave a little self-deprecation there, saying that it's surprising or shocking to people. No, it's not, because it's coming from you. And you now have a track record of being exceptionally accurate with all the things you do. And you very validating as well, because as Abby's talking about the coffee, I held up my coffee mug. I drink coffee multiple times throughout the day. And especially while doing podcasts. And so are nuts okay? Because I eat a lot of nuts. I do enjoy nuts.
That's very good. Yeah.
So that's my snack during and pre podcasting. So thank you for the validation. Always need that. Any final advice before we go for folks? Or is that it?
So the final advice, I think when we think about trust and distrust, it can get so confusing because there's so many things to do, to avoid doing. And so many things to take into consideration. But I try and just break it down into these three key elements to think about. So first, we think about, what is it that we all want above all else? It's safety and psychological comfort from our interactions and from our relationships. Two, how are these needs fulfilled? How do we fulfill those needs of safety and comfort? When we're perceived as trustworthy, we can fulfill those needs, and people can truly put their trust in us. And then finally, knowing that, what are the actionable measures to get there? And the actionable measure is to move away from manipulation, move away from dog-eat-dog attitudes, and those influence tactics are really just manipulation. And think about behavior change towards pro-social influence. So doing good yourself so other people do good, rather than trying to manipulate other people into do good, and trustworthiness.
Yes, 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 yes. Psychological safety, and what are you going to do to provide it for others? It's life in a nutshell. And that's how we're going to change the world, one person at a time, one podcast at a time. With that, Abby, I can't thank you enough again for coming on, being an inspiration for myself, for everyone we reach out and touch. And for everyone listening, stand by for the episode with Abby and Joe. Thanks, everyone, again, for tuning in to the Forged by Trust podcast. Thank you, Abby, for coming on for yet another inspirational day about how to forge trust and make the world a better place.
Thank you so much for having me. It is always a pleasure to be asked. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. If you enjoyed the show, took away a few new tools, I hope you will leave a great review of the show to show your support. If you are interested in more information about how to forge your own trust-building strategies, please visit my website at www.peopleformula.com. You can also follow me on my social media sites included in the show notes. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust episode with you soon.